Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's TOC podcast. I'm Joe Weichert, chair of O'Reilly's Tools of Change Conference. This month's TOC theme is legal, and I'm joined today by Bill Rosenblatt. Bill is a recognized authority on digital media technologies, including digital rights management, as well as on issues related to intellectual property in the online world. He's the author of Copyright and Technology blog, and he's also the founder of Giant Steps Media Technology Strategies. Bill, welcome to this TOC podcast.
Thanks a lot, Joe. It's great to be here.
So, Bill, let's start off with talking about licensing options here. What's your opinion about using the flavors of the Creative Commons licensing model versus, say, a traditional copyright?
Well, first of all, I think that Creative Commons, they did a wonderful job in trying to make an extremely abstruse and complex area of the law tractable and comprehensible to content creators. Copyright law is a huge mess.
Yeah.
And what they've done is they've taken some principles about not only making copyright comprehensible, but also giving content creators a set of choices that are useful ones in the world of particularly digital distribution of content. And so certainly Creative Commons is popular, and it's getting a lot of use and a lot of popularity. I think it's got its limitations, though.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So do you see, though, Creative Commons becoming more popular and useful in this digital-first or digital-only world we're heading into?
Well, it's already very popular, and I don't see any signs of that popularity abating. And certainly there are a lot of not only individuals that have individual content creators who have embraced Creative Commons, but also major online services for content sharing. For example, Flickr is my favorite example, the big photo sharing site owned by Yahoo. They allow their contributors to attach Creative Commons terms to the photos that they upload. And there are a lot of professional photographers who use Flickr to get exposure for their work so that their hope is that people will see their work. People who need to license photographs commercially will see their work and contact them and get commercial licenses. And this brings me to one of the limitations I see in Creative Commons. Creative Commons kind of runs up against the border of the commercial content world, but has never really embraced commercial models. And I think my observation about this is that this is really sort of almost a religious issue with those folks. And I think it's a lost opportunity, because I talk to a lot of publishers who are interested in Creative Commons. They see ways that they could embrace those models for certain types of content and use it and certainly take advantage of it for their to license content commercially and also to offer content on other than commercial terms in order to buttress their commercial businesses in certain ways. But there have been certain attempts by various startups and by organizations like the Copyright Clearance Center to sort of add commercial licensing terms onto Creative Commons. There was something called CC Plus, which is essentially an add-on set of constructs to the Creative Commons set that allows, among other things, commercial terms to be attached to Creative Commons terms. And that really hasn't taken off in the market, and not for lack of trying, but I don't see strong support for that from the Creative Commons organization per se. The other limitation that I see about Creative Commons, and again, this isn't a criticism of the Creative Commons organization. They're doing what they're doing, and it's very successful. But in order to get to the next level, I think that they need to engage more with the commercial content community. The second limitation is that, and this is a limitation with all of copyright, you still have to hire a lawyer if you want to enforce any of these terms. I think the most useful application of Creative Commons in the commercial world is really when you're automating B2B sort of content distribution relationships. Creative Commons gives you a very easy way to convey to a downstream entity what uses you're going to allow and not allow of your content, and you're going to require attribution, for example. You're going to extend share alike terms and things of that nature that Creative Commons allows for. And if you are an aggregator, let's say, like Flickr, for example, then you can automate the process of reading those license terms and honoring them. And then if you're in a contractual relationship with a content supplier and you're doing something that the content supplier thinks is a violation, then they can go after you contractually rather than launching a copyright litigation against you. And that's a lot more straightforward a process. I think in general, the Creative Commons community has not embraced anything about making enforcement of copyright simpler. They don't see it as their job, which again is fine, but it doesn't change the fact that copyright still requires you to hire a lawyer if you want to actually do something about it.
Right, okay. All right, now that's very insightful and really helps me better understand some of the limitations as well. Let's shift gears to talk about the library marketplace for a moment. This is one that really has me scratching my head. I just feel like we should, as publishers, we should treat the library channel like we would any other one. And so we would sell them X copies of an ebook, and they in turn would be free to lend each of those copies out, one patron at a time for each copy, as long as the library wants. So no terms on that as far as when it would expire. And I just think our industry is overcomplicating this model, and that publishers are overly worried about cannibalization when I feel like libraries are really a discovery channel for them. So do you see any legal issues in my point of view?
Yeah, well, there are a lot of legal issues, which I guess I'll start by explaining, hopefully as briefly as possible, what the legal issues are.
Sure.
The most important legal issue is that when you distribute digital piles of bits, digital files, then you are not operating under copyright terms. You are mm-hmm. operating under license terms. So you use the word license. You obviously understand what that means. And license is a contract. And the contract terms can be whatever they're going to be, whereas copyright guarantees the buyer or the acquirer of the work some rights under law. And as it stands now, digital content is not subject to copyright. It is considered to be subject to whatever licensing terms are being offered. And so publishers do not have copyright rights.
Mm-hmm.
They only have the rights available to them in licenses. Now, having said that, let me back off slightly by saying that there is a section of the copyright law called Section 108, which does purportedly confer additional rights on libraries and archives. For things like making sure that there's a backup, being able to restore from a backup, which is, of course, the whole purpose of an archive.
Right.
But when it comes to the ability to lend digitally, Section 108 doesn't really do anything for the libraries. There are a couple of little provisions in there which were written quite a while ago in relative terms, and they don't really do anything for libraries. So libraries are stuck in this licensing regime. And there is a right under copyright called first sale,
mm-hmm.
which is Section 109 of the copyright law, which says that if you legally obtain a work, you buy it or however you come buy it legally, then it's yours to do with as you please. So obviously with a print book, we can give them away, we can lend them, we can resell them. Certainly libraries acquire print books just like anyone would acquire a print book, and then they can lend them, they can ask for them back after a certain length of time. They can fine you if you don't return it in that length of time and all that sort of stuff. So with bits, it's a licensing model, and you'd really need a change in the law to change what is happening between publishers and libraries. And frankly, I actually think that libraries are screwed unless they get a change. I've told them this. I've said this in public. And I've talked to board members of the American Library Association about this,
mm-hmm.
and I just don't see how they win, frankly, because without a change in the law, because publishers are, as you said, starting to dictate different terms or in some cases, like with Simon & Schuster and Macmillan, just refuse to lend at all. And this is something that each publisher can do because they each publisher has a license. And in fact, antitrust law will forbid publishers from getting together and saying, okay, why don't we all just treat library lending of ebooks like print, as you suggested. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's actually a problem from an antitrust standpoint.
Really?
If they collude like that. Well, it's a problem if libraries don't like the terms they're getting. So if publishers were to all get together and do what you just suggested they do, libraries would probably be very happy and no one would complain and there'd be no antitrust complaint from anyone, meaning that it would be fine. But that's unlikely to happen, quite frankly, because there are publishers that just don't see the benefit of library lending. Now, I would actually ask you this question as a publisher and as a wonderful publisher. O'Reilly, I'm an O'Reilly author, and O'Reilly is a fabulous, fabulous publisher. But let me ask you this. Have you guys actually measured the what you call the discovery benefit of the library channel? Have you measured that at all?
I don't think anybody has or can, frankly. It's just too squishy. So it's really just a gut feel on my behalf that I feel like it is an opportunity to showcase our content. And I think I know where you're heading, that, you know, what's to prevent people from just reading the book and never coming back and buying it from us, right?
No, actually, I wasn't heading there, because there are certainly technologies that can be used to prevent that from happening. The way library lending of ebooks works now, they use third-party providers such as OverDrive and a couple of others that support timeouts of the lending period. So let's say it's 3 weeks. Then when 3 weeks is up, your ebook becomes inaccessible. It turns into a pumpkin, so to speak.
Right.
And it's possible to do that. And if you're going into a cloud-based reading model where you're getting, let's say the way Google does it, you're getting page images that you're looking at, then that can be enforced from a server. Then your access is cut off after a lending period is up. That's not a problem. The problem is that publishers will consider this channel, as you put it, beneficial if there's a real business benefit to it. And the other problem that I see for libraries is that the private sector is starting to offer library-like lending style kind of models. And
right.
the prime example of this, no pun intended, is Amazon Prime with the Amazon lending library. I forget what
Kindle Owner Lending Library.
Right, Kindle Owner's Lending Library, exactly. Thank you. And, you know, that I think Amazon's done that, so, you know, Barnes & Noble's going to have to do it, and Kobo's going to have to do it, and whoever comes along next is going to have to, you know, maybe Apple will do it, and whoever else is going to do it. And that's competition. And, you know, let's be clear about that. Amazon put a full-page ad in the New York Times and whatever other major outlets, possibly the Wall Street Journal, basically saying, don't go to your library, go to us.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty much what it said. And that ad cost, you know, give or take $100,000 to place in these big media outlets. Libraries don't have $100,000 to throw around at stuff like that. There's going to be a transition to these private sector models, and publishers will embrace them because of the exposure that they do give authors. And, you know, the Amazon Prime demographic is a desirable demographic. It's people who pay $79 a year for Amazon Prime membership. And so one could see the publisher's viewpoint and say, oh, these are the folks who are more likely to buy our books. And over time, you know, where this goes is you've got the demographics that publishers find desirable gravitating towards these private sector services, which are going to give away more and more stuff in order to make money, more and more money off the back end on other things like devices and who knows what else. And libraries are going to be left with the demographics that, at least in some publishers' perceptions, are considered inferior from a revenue standpoint. And, you know, somebody's going to do surveys and find some way to judge impact of library lending on sales if they haven't done it already. And there's a real risk that the numbers will come out and, you know, whether you believe them or not, they will not look good for libraries. So from a purely business standpoint, and there's a more fundamental issue, libraries are not used to acting like businesses in this way. It's not their mission. Their mission is to spread knowledge and make sure that material is available to their patrons. And, you know, discussions of this business type nature are sort of off mission for them. Whereas publishing companies are businesses, and these are the kinds of discussions they have all the time. So I just don't see this ending well for libraries unless they can advocate for changes in the law that make it possible for them to license material under more favorable terms.
Yeah, and by the way, the whole library topic, I think, after listening to you, makes me realize I'd love to pin you down and do a follow-up conversation with you just about that, because I think there's a lot of information and perspective to mine there. So let's maybe agree to come back to that at some point.
Great complex area.
But I want to switch for a second here to the fact that at O'Reilly, we really like to empower our customers to treat the ebook like they would a print book. And in fact, if you look at the terms of service on O'Reilly.com, you'll see that you're able to resell your ebook or even loan it to somebody else. And the thing there is we go by this sort of Scout's honor policy of if you do sell it to somebody else, we expect you to get rid of the copy that you have and just transfer it over to them. So there's really only one version floating out there. And there's obviously risk in that, but we again feel like we want to trust our customers and empower them. But that brings up this whole notion of, as you said, the first sale doctrine and reselling things like ebooks and digital music. And specifically, I wanted to talk for a moment about this service called Redigi, R-E-D-I-G-I, mm-hmm. That allows consumers today to resell the music they've legitimately purchased. So what do you think the potential legal issues are with something like that? And especially, you know, I'm curious because they might go into ebooks at some point.
Right. Well, if they get that far, which I'm very skeptical about.
Okay.
So digital first sale is something that we have touched on. And let me talk about that for a minute, and then let me switch a little bit to talking about Redigi in particular. So first sale, as we said earlier in this conversation, is judged today not to apply to piles of bits, digital files that are downloaded by users. This is certainly a law that could be changed, and there is certainly a litigation approach to or channel, if you will, to change the law so that first sale will apply to piles of bits as well as to physical products, which includes physical digital products such as CDs and DVDs. Unfortunately, the forces arrayed against first sale are formidable, extremely formidable. First of all, I should mention that 11 years ago, the U.S. Copyright Office was asked to weigh in with an opinion on this in connection with a piece of legislation that was making its way through Congress. And they wrote a report that basically said, and I'm certainly paraphrasing here.
Right.
It's exactly as you said, Joe. It comes down to, should users be trusted to delete the file when they've sent it on to somebody else? And deleting the file is an additional step that a customer needs to take. There are systems that can be put in place to ensure that that happens, and that's what Redigi does, as a matter of fact.
Right.
But failing mandatory use of such systems and standardization of such systems, which gets you to all kinds of thorny issues about monopolies and so forth, and obsolescence, and you know, there are all kinds of issues there. The Copyright Office concluded in 2001 that maybe someday this will be feasible, but it's not now, so it's best to leave well enough alone. They have not revisited that since. Now, of course, that's a long time ago, but that's kind of the prevailing thought from on high, so to speak. Now, if you look at the forces arrayed against digital first sale, you've got most of the entertainment industry companies are dead set against it.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you a particular example of this. Fox Studios, which is a division of News Corp, Rupert Murdoch's News Corp. In the world of movies, you have a term called electronic sell-through, which is what happens when you purchase a digital download of a movie or a TV show from somebody like iTunes.
Okay.
And they use this term because just for their own sort of internal supply chain convenience, because it's analogous to non-electronic sell-through, meaning, you know, selling a DVD or a Blu-ray disc or whatever it is. And it just means that they can treat the sale in the same way from a, you know, royalty perspective, from an accounting perspective, and all these internal ways that they need to treat sales. So they call it electronic sell-through, but not Fox. Fox does not want to use the term sale or sell, because that would make it look like it's a sale, which would then be presumably covered under for sale, Section 109.
As opposed to a license, you mean?
Well, they call it electronic licensing.
Okay.
They refuse to use the term electronic sell-through, which is actually an industry standard term in Hollywood other than at Fox. Mm-hmm. So there are massive forces from the entertainment industry are against digital first sale. Many commercial publishers are likely against digital first sale. And then just as importantly, the retailers are against digital first sale. Mm-hmm. If you're Amazon or Apple or Barnes & Noble or anybody else, then you are disadvantaged if you allow customers or users to buy things from other users, or if you're going to sell a DRM'd ebook the way Amazon usually does, or the way Barnes & Noble usually does, then you want people to stay on the ranch, so to speak, and you don't want to give consumers the ability to go off the ranch, which would be required if you supported digital first sale. Mm-hmm. So you've got two enormous communities, and the same goes for the device makers. Amazon, of course, is also a device maker. The device makers want your content to just be on your devices. And of course, that's a gross generalization. There are many device makers that are not retailer affiliated, like Samsung would be one example, which does a little bit in music, but not very much. They want to emphasize sharing and all the wonderful things that you can do with your digital content on one of their devices. But the retailers, Apple and Amazon particularly, and Barnes & Noble that also offer devices, want you, the consumer, to stay within their environment. And so they're against digital first sale too. So that brings us to Redigi. Now, everyone, Redigi would like this to be considered a fair use or first sale issue.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, we're enabling consumers to resell their lawfully obtained music files, and if you resell it, then, you know, you're doing exactly as the term suggests. You're selling it. Whoever buys it is then the owner, and you the seller are allowed to do this because it's your right under first sale, it's your right under fair use to do that. Well, first of all, we've already heard about how first sale doesn't apply to bits.
Right.
And so that's one issue. But there's a whole nother issue which the litigation is not touching, which is whether Amazon or Apple's, and first, I should explain for listeners who may not be familiar, Redigi allows you to resell only those music files that you have bought on Amazon or iTunes, Apple mm-hmm. iTunes. Just those two services, which, you know, sell unencrypted, DRM-free MP3s, and you know, you can, from a physical or logistical standpoint, certainly do whatever you want with those files once you've gotten them. And Redigi will only allow you to sell those files, and it will ensure or try to ensure as best as it can, the system can be circumvented, that your copy is deleted when you resell it. But the question is, do Amazon and Apple actually allow you to do this? The answer is no, they don't. If you look in their terms of service, they say that you agree, and I'm again paraphrasing, you agree that the files you obtain are for your personal use only, that you have no right to transfer them to anyone else or to make unauthorized copies, you know, whatever it says. It's a violation of the terms of service to do this. So the litigation is being brought by Capitol Records, which is EMI, which is one of the major soon to become part of Universal Music Group, the largest music company in the world. They're certainly not touching the terms of service issues because the terms of service are put out by the retailer. Mm-hmm. But there's a whole retailer component to this that has yet to become an issue in litigation. And I think it's only a matter of time, if Redigi makes it far enough for Apple and Amazon to care, I think it's only a matter of time before you see one or both of those piling on to Redigi, making their legal bills even higher.
But, you know, if I can just interrupt for a second, because there's two aspects of Redigi that, as a publisher, I really like. And I certainly respect the legal issues, although it seems like what we've got is a legal framework that is sort of based on how things operated yesterday, and now we're trying to solve problems for tomorrow. But with Redigi, the thing that's appealing to me is in talking with their CEO, John Ossenmacher, they have the ability to authenticate, as you said, those purchases from Amazon and Apple. And of course, you know, any system can be gamed or hacked, but at least they're doing their best to try to prove that those are authentic purchases. And then I guess the bigger piece that's of interest to me is how they are passing part of the transaction back to the label for the music, and then in turn the artist. And then presumably, if they were to get into ebooks, to the publisher and the author, which today you don't find, obviously, with your second time around bookstore, right?
Well, yeah. And I actually think that that's going to get them into trouble. They're doing that certainly to build good relationships with the record labels. And my understanding is that apart from EMI, they have some good relationships with record labels. But if you're going to say we're giving a piece of the transaction back to the publisher,
mm-hmm.
The bedrock fundamental legal principle behind first sale, which is known outside the U.S. under the term exhaustion, is that the rights holder, in this case, it would be an author or a publisher. In the case of music, it's a record label. It's more clear cut. In publishing, it's a little different because you have authors who own copyrights. But the rights holder exhausts all rights in the work after a transaction has made in which a person legally obtains the work.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to start to get into issues like, well, wait a minute, when there's a resale, a piece of it goes to the record label, or a piece of it goes to the author or the publisher, then that's a little bit hard to justify with regard to the purpose of first sale, which is rights exhaustion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think I understand why they're doing it, and there may be some record label people who think that this is a pretty good idea. You know, there is no doubt that many record labels and many musical artists would love to be able to get a piece of any resale transaction. And in fact, there's what I would call the artist rights community out there. On blogs such as The Tricordist is my favorite. This musician named David Lowry, who is with Camper Van Beethoven, they hate first sale. You know, they want first sale to go away, and they want, again, an exaggeration and a paraphrasing. They would like to get a piece of every first sale or subsequent resale transaction.
Mm-hmm.
But that's really, from a legal principle standpoint, that's not what first sale is supposed to do. It's supposed to facilitate, as you said, physical media item transactions.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in fact a law that applies to physical products that is being retrofitted, if you will, onto the digital world. I think it's going to take a while to work these issues out. My opinion of Redigi is that they're kind of a pawn in a much bigger game than their own game. For example, Google tried to file an amicus brief on behalf of Redigi in this case, and I may be wrong, but my understanding is that the judge said, no, you have no standing to file an amicus brief, so he told Google to get lost. But there are a lot of major legal issues, and there are a lot of forces with skin in the game that are sort of looking at this and bearing down on it. For example, Ossenbacher claims that they got legal advice from experts that said, you know, well, this is a first sale right, or it's a fair use right, and so therefore you're operating within the law. And, you know, I can't help but feel that whoever advised them had an axe to grind.
Mm-hmm.
What those opinions are, in a legal gray area. In fact, I talked about this, the terms of service issue and the issue of which prevails, a term of service issue, a term in the terms of service, or copyright law terms. If they're in conflict with each other, which one prevails?
Mm-hmm.
That would be a very good guess. And I asked someone who's a leading litigator in this area on the tech industry side. He writes briefs on behalf of the Googles and Yahoos of the world. And even he said, you know, the ink is not dry on this area yet. It's going to take a while for this to kind of shake out. So I can't help but think that Redigi is being used as a pawn in a much bigger game. Now, where this game comes out, I can't tell you. But what I will say is that the forces against Redigi succeeding are formidable.
Hmm. That's unfortunate, because I'm rooting for them, because I think that there's an interesting angle that they've got. But nevertheless, that might be another great topic to circle back on once that ruling comes in. The last area I wanted to ask you about today, Bill, is piracy, which, of course, is illegal. But, you know, some would say that we have bigger problems to worry about. And Tim O'Reilly and others have even said that obscurity is a bigger problem than piracy, particularly as discoverability gets harder and harder as more and more products are out there. And I respect the fact that we've got to protect our intellectual property. But if somebody decides that piracy actually can give lift to their visibility and to their sales, you know, you wonder, is that sort of a viable marketing strategy? And then if so, are there legal aspects that come into play if you kind of look away from some of the piracy that's happening to your content? Or do you feel like intellectual property owners need to aggressively go after pirates and issue takedown notices?
Well, I would say, first of all, that Tim O'Reilly is absolutely right unless and until you become famous.
Right.
What you're seeing out here right now is a dichotomy. You've got artists that are not well known, or their works are not well known, and so-called piracy, it's actually a term that was not invented by Jack Valenti at the MPAA. It's been around for centuries, but I still don't like the term particularly. You know, encouragement of unauthorized distribution. Maybe there's not a nice, clean term like piracy or a simple term like piracy. But certainly, if you're not well known, then distributing your work wherever you can is going to help you. You know, there's no question about that. But, you know, it's not going to – piracy doesn't help Lady Gaga, right?
Right.
Piracy doesn't help Suzanne Collins or J.K. Rowling. And at a certain point, you kind of flip the switch from wanting exposure for your work to wanting revenue from your work. And
mm-hmm.
we can argue about – are Lady Gaga and J.K. Rowling making too much money? You know, do they deserve to make that much money? That's a sort of a separate argument, and you could go on forever about that. But certainly there's a dichotomous situation with regard to when piracy benefits you and when it doesn't. Now, interestingly, there have been a lot of studies done about this. There have been a lot of studies done specifically about the revenue effect of copyright infringement. And there was also a sort of meta study that was done in 2010 by the GAO, what used to be called the General Accounting Office, which is now called the Government Accountability Office. It's a nonpartisan think tank in Washington. And they looked at a lot of studies, not just about digital infringement, but also physical goods infringement, i.e. counterfeiting.
Mm-hmm.
And they sort of looked at the studies and said, these studies are by and large either irredeemably biased or methodologically flawed, or both. And therefore, they're all worthless. And by the way, it may not ever be possible to do a study that has any validity whatsoever on this area. So yeah, infringement's a problem, counterfeiting's a problem, but we may never know just how big of a problem it is. And my response to that is, first of all, I've read a lot of those studies, and yes, you cannot, for example, trust a study that was financed by the MPAA to be objective.
Mm-hmm.
Can't do it. Nor can you trust a bunch of academics to know enough about the real world to do a study that is methodologically sound. On the other hand, and the academics may also have limited resources that some commercial market research outfit may not. So there are a lot of studies, and yeah, they have flaws, they have biases, but you know, you can't just throw up your hands and say, I don't know. You have to start from somewhere.
Right.
So if you do, and you know, these, you know, for better or for worse, we live in a capitalistic world. Media companies are businesses. They're looking to make money. And so they want to have an understanding of what effect infringement does have on their revenue. There have been a lot of studies done. And if you sort of make a chart with all of the figures and you average them all or whatever, on the one hand, you know, you do get an outcome that says infringement does cost revenue to the copyright industries. But on the other hand, you have to say that these studies are all apples to oranges and you can't really compare them because they measure different things, regardless of whether they do so accurately or with valid methodologies. Now, having said that, there is one particular study that was done 5 years ago that attempts to tease apart, and this is very difficult, the promotional effect of infringement versus the revenue detrimental effect of infringement.
Hmm.
So what? Yes, there's infringement. Yes, people make unauthorized copies. We all know that. But certainly there is a promotional benefit, even for a title, for example, a film coming out of a major studio or a blockbuster novel or what have you. There certainly is a promotional effect to copies that are not authorized. But there's also a sales displacement effect. Now, certainly I don't believe that every infringed copy is a lost sale. But what
right.
this showed, it came up with a result that roughly one-third of the effect of infringement is promotional value, and the other two-thirds is revenue reduction.
Hmm.
So that's one result, but it's about movies, and it was done in 2007. So does that apply to publishing? Probably not. You know, and does it apply, for example, to the kind of publishing that O'Reilly does, books about information technology sold to a largely professional audience versus novels, versus trade fiction, versus romance, versus other types of publishing, you know, let alone music or TV or images or any other kind of content. So I think that there will be more studies. People will find out more information. Even though the studies are not perfect, you have to start somewhere.
Right, right.
Still stand. You know, I think I'm going to go back to something I said at the beginning of this conversation, which is that copyright laws do very little to enforce copyright nowadays unless you can hire lawyers. There really isn't any way to protect your copyright if you don't have lawyers to go around suing people or threatening to go around suing people. So we're relying on various technological means to protect copyright, and we're relying on, you know, hoping that people do the right thing or making it easy to do the right thing or giving them a very good value proposition that's easier and more convenient than doing something that's against the law. We're relying on those business aspects of it rather than any real legal enforcement, because there really isn't any legal enforcement unless you can afford to hire lawyers and wait X number of years. And I'll just close with a favorite anecdote of mine about this. There's a wonderful conference that the Copyright Clearance Center puts on called On Copyright, which takes place every, I think, spring in New York. And, or at least it has been in New York. They may do it elsewhere. But it's a very open-ended exploration of copyright issues. There's no agenda. They just get a lot of people from different backgrounds to get up there and talk. And there was an indie musician who spoke. Now, this is someone who is very much on the, you know, Creative Commons kind of, you know, fair use side of the issue. But on the other hand, she's a musician who needs to make a living. And she's on the board, I think, of the Future of Music Coalition and all that stuff, Berkman Center and so forth. And she's very ambivalent. She gave a talk that basically said, you know, I'm in favor of content being unfettered and all that stuff, and, you know, copyright law being balanced and so forth. But There was a time when my music was used by some Eastern European company for TV ads, as back TV ads. And I wanted to get paid for that use. I didn't want punitive damages. I just wanted to get paid a fair royalty for that use of my music. And I was told by lawyers that it would take several years to maybe get something back, and it would certainly not be worth what I would have to pay in legal fees to get it, if I was after a reasonable royalty as opposed to, you know, punitive damages, millions of dollars in punitive damages. So you have to look at that and say, you know, is copyright working? And I have to say the answer is no, it's not, from a purely legal standpoint. If you're looking to legal remedies, there really aren't very many unless you can afford to hire expensive lawyers.
Yeah, and isn't that unfortunate? But you've given us a ton to think about today, Bill, and I hope you'll allow us to check back with you from time to time to pick your brain about more issues on the legal front. So, Bill Rosenblatt, thanks so much for talking with us today on this TOC podcast.
Thank you.